gonna be there when I make it there. I've just been wondering, it is still in the same old spot.
I don't know, Lanny, but with the daddy you played that disco enough, they got to be there.
You know, I'm just getting back. I've been in state prison.
I wasn't down there anymore.
Bad on me. And you know, it was shame on everybody else.
Yes, I used to hear about how they used to rain them big bills.
Yeah.
And every morning by the break of day, you could hear how it is going on every day.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. This is Ruth Kovach and glad to see you all listening to us again. You were just listening to the great Lightnin' Hopkins. I have a new CD. It's called Penitentiary Blues and it's Songs to Do Hard Time By. And this particular CD is the best music from New Orleans and Louisiana with great artists at a low price. And the proceeds of this CD go to the victims of Katrina. So I thought I'd share some of these songs with you tonight. We're going to take a look at a review of women in prison as presented by Amy Goodman later. And we're going to look at three groups in Portland who support people who are incarcerated. But first, let's hear our words from Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
The meanings of Haditha. The Haditha massacre, where several dozen Iraqi men, women, and babies were liquidated by American forces, found its way into the news months after the gory events. The Haditha massacre ain't the first time. It won't be the last. Since when does the nation's military need Time magazine to inform it of a massacre of dozens of innocent Iraqi civilians? The simple yet unavoidable truth is that no one cared what happened to those people. They were just Iraqis. In the words of American soldiers, they were Hajis, a term that is but an echo of another term from decades ago, used against another people whom the Americans were trying to crush. Those people were the Vietnamese, and in American soldiers speak, they were gooks. Those ugly words betray the inherent sense of superiority that undergirds wars in the so-called Third World. A half century ago, a great European civilization used similar words against a segment of their own people. That civilization was Germany, and it referred to the Jewish and Romani minorities in their country as Untermensch, German for subhuman. I bring up the Nazi regime for one reason. European history of World War II is replete with occasions when stormtroopers wiped out whole villages to intimidate the occupants of their conquered territories about the intrinsic worth of German life and the worthlessness of the occupied peoples. These were acts of state terrorism meant to inflict terror on civilian populations. That's what Haditha means. They acted not in the depth of darkness, nor in the shadowy precincts of a gulag like Abu Ghraib. They did it in broad daylight. They didn't care that Iraqis saw what they were doing. In fact, they wanted them to see it, to spread the message. What message? Terror. To teach the Hajis a lesson. In the poetry journal Mishnah, poet Sinan Khatib wrote in the poem aptly entitled Cheap Blood, "You need not worry. You can kill me. I am Arab. My blood is cheap. I'm really sorry. I really am. I have so many children and a big family. But you can kill them too. They are Arab. Their blood is cheap," he writes. Sometimes a poem condenses 1,000 words. In the wake of Haditha and Hamdaniya in Abu Ghraib, we hear the harrowing echo of Khatib's poem, Cheap Blood. Such is always the way of empires. It would be nice to expect that the system will somehow stop this kind of carnage. Nice, naive even. But it won't happen. Many of us over the age of 50 remember the My Lai massacre of Vietnam. We remember not just the massacre, but the cover-ups attempted by the U.S. military until an article appeared by a GI, Ron Ridenour, and articles were published in several French publications. The journalist Seymour Hersh wrote about it for the anti-war press. Meanwhile, the mainstream American press ignored it. Sound familiar? One American officer was convicted and given life in prison. In 3 years, he was out and pardoned for mass murder. How little things have changed. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These Thank you, Mumia.
Produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Mumia always has something good to say to us. One comment he started his talk with today was, no one cares. And I think that most of the movements that we try to participate in are often doing less than they can, less than they should, because no one cares. Well, I care, and Amy Goodman cares, and recently on Democracy Now!, she presented a segment of her program about women in prison because Amy Goodman cares. And I wanted to review a little bit about that tonight. It was presented by KBOO at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'm thinking that some of the Prison Pipeline audience doesn't get a chance to hear the radio at 11. So if you did hear it, forgive me for repeating it, but I will have a few comments of my own. And if you did hear it, remember it, and remember it well, because it was certainly a worthy program. Amy Goodman was talking to Eve Ensler, an award-winning author of the play The Vagina Monologues, among others, and Kimberly Crenshaw, the professor of law at both UCLA and Columbia Law School. They were discussing the fact that they had run some writing programs at Bedford Hills Prison about 8 years ago. And actually, they started to talk to many of the women, and they interviewed the women, and they began a writing class. And in this writing class, each of the women were able to free themselves and get into writing and say things that they had never said to anyone before, maybe not even to themselves. And some of those readings were read, and it was certainly a beautiful program. If you have access to review this program on the web or something, it's sure worth listening to. One of the things Eve Ensler said was, I couldn't believe how smart these women were and how hungry they were for a way to process what they had done and what had been done to them. And she also said, during the process of that group, I quickly discovered that most of the women in the group at some point in their life had been radically abused, not just a little abused, radically abused, and that violence that had a complete direct impact on the violence that they eventually caused or perpetrated. And so in the course of the writing, when the women were able to articulate their guilt and thinking about what had happened, they started to see that perhaps they weren't as guilty and they shouldn't take all the blame. And the listeners start to understand that all of us perhaps should look at the system and decide just who is to blame when wrong is going on. Can we make it right by helping and observing and listening and learning? And so these ladies participated in the program, doing their writing and doing their reading. And after Eve Ensler spoke a bit, they were joined by Kimberly Crenshaw. And one of the things Kimberly Crenshaw had to say was that the relationship between violence and incarceration is something we have to look at. She says, I like to call this a tale of two movements because, frankly, there's been an anti-violence movie that hasn't really dealt with the consequences of violence for women who are incarcerated, or how incarceration is often a precursor to violence, so that whole relationship hasn't been explored. There's also an anti-incarceration movement that more or less just focuses pretty much on men, how men wind up being incarcerated and some of the consequences. But actually, some of those same causes can be applied to both men and women. You know, I started thinking about this, and I think the point she's making is that most issues are multi-issue. And I thought, well, I'm going to take a series of words, and I'm going to make a little chain out of them, and I'm going to explain to you, my listening audience, just how one thing leads to another. But it isn't that simple. Instead, I wound up making a circle. And I want you to connect the dots, and you will soon find that the dots cross the circle many times in many directions. We have poverty, which leads to drug and alcohol, and drug and alcohol people often are perpetrators of domestic violence, which leads to crime, and the crime leads to incarceration, and in incarceration, They continue their drug and alcoholism. They continue their violence. They come out of the incarceration, and they are now unemployed, unemployable, and often homeless, and in a state of poverty, which leads to drugs and crime, which leads to alcoholism, which leads to violence. I think you're getting the idea, aren't you? That each thing snowballs, and one of these tragic positions or situations for a person to be in is a big trap that just sucks you down, because when you have one, instead of improving and pulling out of it, you have these others all on the edge pulling at you. Alcoholism, violence, crime, incarceration, homelessness, and so on. But I'll go on now with some of the Amy Goodman show. Kimberly Crenshaw pointed out that women who are incarcerated for murdering men, 90% of those women have been victimized by those very men in the past. So this is basically the last step in a long process leading up to that particular act that led those women to prison. But even more broadly than that, most women who are incarcerated, not simply for homicide, but for any other kind of crime, have been subject to violence in the past. And you add to that that the majority of women who are incarcerated are, number one, primary caretakers for children. Boy, we can't forget that. We can't forget that for a minute, because the children really are the innocents in all of this. Number two, most of them have had some history of not only violence, but drug abuse of some sort. What we're beginning to see is a whole picture of all the ways that women are subject to a whole range of violent factors in society, and this is the final step for them, or at least the step that leads them into prison. Kimberly Crenshaw went on later in the program to say, "The racial dimension is incredible. We have 8 times as many women in prison today as we had in 1980. It's the fastest growing group of women who are incarcerated, and the proportion of African American women who are incarcerated is growing even faster than the incidence of women being imprisoned." You know, there's a pattern here. Let's look at who's unemployed. Let's look who's in poverty. And let's look who they, and I say that with a capital T, want to hold down, want to keep in the servitude strata of our social class system. So we go on. I could just talk about everything that every person said on this program, and I hope that you had a chance to hear it. But I did want to mention another thing that Kimberly Crenshaw said. A majority of women who are homeless have had a history of violence, and then being homeless makes you vulnerable to violence. Golly, isn't that what I've just been telling you? One thing leads to another. The chain reaction goes on. More particularly, when women get out, the consequences, the collateral consequences of having been incarcerated are profound. And here's something that we on the outside could really do something about. We have to face the facts that this is the consequence of someone who's been incarcerated for whatever reason, and do what we can to help them adjust to society. They are now a member of our society. They are now our neighbors, and let's do what we can for them. Women who have been incarcerated, I'm continuing to quote Ms. Crenshaw now, women who have been incarcerated because of drug crimes, for example, can no longer get any other kind of public benefit. They can't get public housing. They can't get education grants. They can't get resources to raise their children. So they're basically marking them with, like, a permanent letter that says, you can no longer contribute to society anymore. And yet we want to say, let's rehabilitate them. Let's accept them into society. Well, there's a lot of work to be done in this area, folks. And I hope that as we review these prison pipeline programs week after week, that you become more and more aware of what work there is to be done and that you get on the bandwagon and help us with that work. Amy Goodman asked, how often do the police make a deal that says, if you turn over someone, we'll give you a better deal? And Kimberly answered her, the men will many times turn over the women, and the women will not turn over the men, either because they don't have any information or women just don't tend to do that, right? And Eve chimed in saying, they're loyal. They're loyal, yeah. I also just want to say in terms of that, too, like, I always laugh about this term, correctional facility. You know, correctional? That does sound like a verb, like we're doing something to change. And my impression of correctional facilities is that they're hardening facilities. You know, they're in places that freeze people and keep them exactly who they are, or worse than when they first came in. Well, that's about all that I'm going to say to you today about the Amy Goodman program. I hope I've motivated you to look it up on the web if you have access to it. And I hope I've brought to your attention again that the incarcerated women have a problem. We're going to hear a little music, and then I'm going to talk about three Portland organizations that you should all know about.
Jail. Well, here I am, locked up in this county jail. Well, it's on a Sunday, and no one to go my bail. Run for my mother. Tell her the shape I'm in. Run for my mother. Tell her the shape I'm in. Well, I'm locked up in this county jail. And I haven't got no friend. Yes, when you're locked up in jail, you ain't got no friend. I'm way down here in this county jail. Well, everything will be all right. Just phone my mother and she'll take the case.
Okay, there's more to that, but we're going to try to get you interested in getting this CD so you hear it. That was Champion Jack Dupree. He's done other songs from prison. But, you know, he's not just making those words up because he read a book about being in jail. He's been there, done that, and he speaks from the heart and he speaks from his soul. And I think that perhaps it's enlightening to some of you who really haven't ever quite grasped the horrors of being incarcerated, especially in some of the particularly cruel prisons in this nation. And I'm told that in the Louisiana district and in the South, the prisons are even harsher than the ones in Oregon or any other state that we often talk about. And this attention that we've had towards the problems of the prisoners in New Orleans after Katrina should bring to your attention the kind of lack of caring, and thank you, Mamiya, for reminding us. If you don't care, nothing's going to happen. So I'm hoping that you'll care. Well, here's three groups that care. Here in Portland, we have, I guess I had some notes here. We have a couple book groups that get books to prisoners, and we have the Western Prison Project. At most prisons, there are very few books available, and often these consist of mainly low-quality pulp fiction, like romance novels or action thrillers. But people in prison, for many reasons, the vast majority are in for nonviolent crimes. The U.S. currently has over 2 million incarcerated people in state and federal prisons. Two-thirds are people of color. The prison industrial complex is a huge system that needs a great deal of radical reform. One thing we can do to reach out to people held prisoner in this system is to provide a few books to help these folks pass the time and try to educate themselves. Please join us in this effort. This is the message of Books to Oregon Prisoners. They use the acronym BTOP, in case you've ever seen it. It's an all-volunteer program that sends educational books to people in prisons all over the country. We're looking for books, they say, with educational content, dictionaries and thesauruses, our biggest request. A thesaurus and a dictionary. Sounds like these prisoners are writing. They want everyone to know their story. If they write it only for themselves, they have to get it on paper. Writing is such a wonderful tool for the prisoners. We also need history, law, African American, indigenous, Latino, queer studies, literature by and for women, books in Spanish, and radical fiction. Hardcovers cost a lot more to ship, but if they're in a good condition, they may have some value for shipping funds. I wanted to tell you a little bit more about the Books to Oregon Prisoners. It's a nonprofit organization whose primary goal is to empower incarcerated people to educate themselves. This is what it's all about. They must become aware of a good critical analysis of where they are, why they're there, what to do about it, and start to understand how their life has taken the path that it's taken. Also, recently, the Books to Oregon Prisoners has been approved to bring used books into prison libraries in Oregon. This is exciting because used books are much easier to come by than new ones. They've taken almost 1,000 books to 5 different prisons so far and are planning trips to the most distant prisons across the state. And here's a message to you. If you are making a trip to Eastern or Southern Oregon and could take a few boxes of books along with you, please let Books to Oregon Prisoners know. The other Books to Prisoner organization is called the Black Rose Collective, and sometimes it's referred to as Portland Books to Prisoners. Black Rose is a community-owned business based on the principles of cooperation and competition. Excuse me. Serving the rich cultural and economic diversity of our neighborhood, Black Rose Collective seeks to provide the education and tools to recognize and respond to all forms of oppression. Black Rose has an extensive collection of radical and hard-to-find literature and media for sale, as well as a large free library of books, and their volunteers send books to prisoners, and we could support them. And finally, the third group that I want to talk about was the Western Prison Project. Now, I like to talk about how I feel and what I think, and I like to listen to stories of people who have been in prison. But one source, when you really want the facts, when you want some data, when you want some statistics, when you want some right-from-the-heart true stories of real people, you can go on the web to the Western Prison Project. And in the Western Prison Project, you'll find all kinds of information. But I want to be sure you know that this is a regional effort comprised in the state of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Utah, Wyoming, and Nevada that advocates for prison reform to reduce the criminal justice system reliance on incarceration. Okay, the Western Prison Project works hard and are strong advocates for prison reform. So if you go on the web to the Western Prison Project, you're going to find all sorts of information, current issues in prison, things about health care, things about the way they're fed, things about privatization of prisons. By the way, in a week or two, I want to give a program on just privatization of prisons. There's a lot to look at there, but for tonight, I'll just say I'm against it. Today, Western Prison Project is an independent nonprofit funded by partner organizations and donations from members of Western Prison Projects. Through legislative advocacy, WPP's members, primarily prisoners, former prisoners, and their families, work to increase the amount of funding for prisoners and prisons' reentry services. Okay, how do you get in touch with these organizations? I wrote that down. It's on one of these pieces of paper. Ah, here it is. Books to Oregon Prisoners. Here's an email address. Hope you got your pencils. Books, B-O-O-K-S, to prisoners at gmail.com. That's the Books to Prisoners organization, to Oregon prisoners, books2prisoners@gmail.com. The Black Rose Collective, another fine organization working very hard to get books in the hands of prisoners. This is all lowercase, blackrosecollective@riseup.net. So that's Black, BlackRoseCollective, at riseup.net. And finally, we have the Western Prison Project, and their email address is info@westernprisonproject.org, all one word. These are places that you can either email and ask for information. Sorry about that. Or you could go to Google and put in the names of these organizations and look for information. And it's not just enough to look them up and say, oh, isn't that nice? Look what they're doing. How about helping them out? How about sending them a note that encourages them? How about sending them a note that thanks them? How about becoming a part of this movement? I think that the people who are incarcerated that listen to Prison Pipeline and the families and loved ones and friends of such folks, we don't have to convince them that this work is important. We don't have to convince them that they should participate and they should help. I'd like to say a few words to you folks who have absolutely no relationship at all to anyone who's ever been incarcerated. I spoke to a group of young people today, and I asked them all, I said, I think the oldest one there was 14. I said, raise your hand if you think you'll be homeless before you're 21. Well, nobody put their hand up. Raise your hand if you think you'll be in jail. Nobody raised their hand. Well, raise your hand if you think you'll be on drugs or alcohol addiction. Nobody raised their hand. So what was it all about? The folks who least suspect that someone they know, a family member, a neighbor, a very good friend, will be in a situation that right now they think is unthinkable. The old cliche, it won't happen to me, is really something that keeps folks from participating. It's really something that puts you in that group that Mamiya was talking about when he said, no one cares. But I'd like to say, so what if no one you know or care about becomes desperate? Don't you realize that when you go out at night and you think you're afraid of people that you might meet on the street, when you shrink up and quiver a bit when someone panhandles and asks you for a dollar, that there's two things that are happening. One is you don't really know that person, how they got there, why they got there. And two, you're doing nothing to get them off the street. Well, getting them off the street doesn't mean lock them up. That doesn't get them off the street. What gets them off the street is the movements and the work and the participation in projects that relieve homelessness, poverty, drug addiction. A couple of weeks ago, I had someone here from RAP, a rehabilitation for alcohol and drug program, trying to help people with funding. All you folks, we're asking you for dollars for KABU. We're asking you for dollars for your favorite organization. But the bottom line is that the funding for organizations which provide health, welfare, and education to the folks who are in our streets, who are in our prisons, the funding is being cut, cut, cut. And that funding is a very big issue here in Portland. When the Multnomah County hearings talked about funding cuts, I went to hearings. Well, I think I went to three different ones, and one night I heard 92 people each get up and talk about their issue, and what they had to say was, the people in our program need this money. And then they told very sad and touching stories, and each person told about how, because a certain organization had provided services to them, they survived. They didn't die. Their life is useful. Their life is meaningful. And everyone I heard, I said to myself, oh, I'm here to represent a certain organization, and we don't want our money cut, but I don't want their money. And then someone else would get up and speak, and they would tell about the problems they had. And I'd say, well, I don't want their money. So after a few nights of that, of thinking, why are we talking about who gets cut? Why don't we talk about where is the money going? What can we do to increase the amount of money in budgets on a county, city, state, national level so that cuts in welfare and health and education stop? All cuts in health, welfare, and education are inhumane. They're wrong. They're immoral. What we need is to keep the money flowing for these services. And the way to keep the money flowing might be to put a better tax on some of the large corporations, some of who only pay $10 a year. Another thing we might do would be to demand that certain large industry and corporate officers, so that executives don't get salaries of $1 million a year. And we certainly have to do something to divert the money that's going to the war and put it back into the budgets for the people here at home in health, welfare, and education. So I kind of got off the subject of prison pipeline, but you know, I never got off the subject because I'm back to my first thing that I was saying, that connecting the dots. If we don't support, if we don't participate in the movements for improvements in health, welfare, and education programs in Portland, in Oregon, in the United States, in the world, we will have poverty. And as long as we have poverty, we will have alcoholism, drug addiction, crime, incarcerations that are unjustified, and the cycle continues. Fighting a war and getting rid of the terrorists has certainly some purpose if it had been a legitimate war. But does it really solve the problems that we have here at home? The problems we have here at home are poverty. The problems we have here at home is a class system where the working class is exploited by the people who hold the money and the power. Well, I'm going to go on now, but I think I'll play a little music and maybe we'll come back.
I said myself Saturday, huh? Okay, Miss Austin.
It don't look like the penitentiary. Oh, Lord, what made for poor me? It don't look like the penitentiary. Oh, Lord, the penitentiary was made for me. But you know, they said it was made for people. I turn to a horse, don't you see? That's to keep them going.
Hope you've been enjoying some of the music from the Penitentiary Blues CD that I brought in today, and I hope that the Prison Pipeline audience will tune in again at 6:30 Tuesday next week. Reggae Bob should be here to host, and if he isn't here, I'll be here, but there will be a Prison Pipeline show. But you know what? I just thought of something. It's the 4th of July. There is not going to be a Prison Pipeline show on the 4th of July, so 2 weeks from tonight, tune in for Prison Pipeline. And Reggie Bob and I will co-host or greet you with a good program. And thank you for listening. And thank you for being such a good audience.